Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold. Welcome back, everyone, to Your Cases on Hold. This is episode 57. This is May 7th, if you're listening on the day we drop, or the May 8th issue of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery. As always, I'm Andrew Schoenfeld, Deputy Editor for Methods. And across the way, I have...
Antonia Chen, Deputy Editor for Adult Reconstruction.
For those who may be joining for the first time or haven't regularly listened in the past, the opinions that you're going to hear today are those of the co-hosts only and are not reflective of the editorial board, the editors-in-chief, editors of the constituent journals, or the board of trustees. As always, hit the like and subscribe, get the notifications, check out our back issues on any of the podcast platforms where you're listening. Give us a five-star rating if you can. That helps us out and helps the journal out. Spread the word. Tell your friends, and we look to engage more listeners as we continue to grow. This episode is brought to you by JBJS CME. The CME opportunities at the journal continue to grow. They continue to allow you to get credit for work that you're doing with maintenance of certification. Read the issues, take the tests, get the CME. There's so many different learning opportunities and engagement, clinical classroom, the self-assessment exam tests that give you credit also towards maintenance of certification. It's really the gift that keeps on giving, right? So check that out if you can.
Those gifts. We got to keep recertifying, so it's a good win.
It just is an ongoing, never-ending process. So yeah, you'll continue to need to engage there, no matter where you are in your career. So without that further considerations, let's get into what's on the top of the pile. So we have Assessing the Diversity of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery Editorial Boards by Okike. This is permanently free, so that can be checked out at any time. Interesting content, illustrative content. Then we have Primary Care Physician Preferences Regarding Communications from Orthopedic Surgeons by Kyoto and colleagues. There's an infographic for this. It's also 30 days free. Next up, The Ethics of International Medical Tourism by Zhang, followed by AOA Critical Issues Symposium. So You Want to Be a Department Leader, Essentials for Success. This is by Lieberman. Then we have Acetabular Dysplasia After Successful Open or Closed Treatment of Developmental Hip Dysplasia in a Biologic Failure, not Acetabular Deficiency by Weinstein. Then we have What's Important, Private Equity Arrangements in Orthopedic Surgery, Enter at Your Own Risk by Lakowitz. This is also permanently free. And you thought we were done, but wait, there's more. Implementing a Hospitalist Co-Management Service in Orthopedic Surgery by Ghanem and colleagues. And then Comparing the Biomechanical Stability of Cerclage Cable with Plate Insert versus Locking Screws in Periprosthetic Humeral Fracture by Lee and colleagues. And then last but not least, Dynamic Foot Pressure During Walking, a Potential Indicator of Bone Mineral Density by Choi and colleagues. That's what's on the top of the pile. Let's see what's happening in the headlines. So my headline is, do transtibial amputations outperform amputations of the hind and midfoot following severe limb trauma? A secondary analysis of the outlet study. This is by Fram and colleagues, and there's also an infographic for this. Interesting work that is a retrospective review of data collected for that outlet study. This study included patients 18 to 60 who were treated with a transtibial amputation or a distal amputation. A more distal amputation is what that is really indicative of, who were enrolled in this prospective observational study. Now, the clinical paradigm at play here is that more distal amputations have the theoretical advantage of improving body image, ambulatory capacity over short distances without need for a prosthesis, improved energy costs. That's like an OITE question. from back in the day. We were always focused on that. The purpose of the current study is to compare outcomes at 18 months post-injury for patients with lower limb trauma. And the way they pitch this is that there's some data, a lot of it heavily confounded, but and mostly around patients with like diabetic or infectious conditions that led to the amputation. And this is a obviously a post-trauma population. And they say despite the theoretical benefits of a hindfoot or midfoot amputation, they feel that patients with transtibial amputations would report better function and have fewer complications than those with hindfoot or midfoot amputations. I think some of that is kind of already pretty well established. Like they hypothesize that they would find the same things that you hear about these surgeries already in the literature. They readily admit in their statistical section, because of the small sample size, comparisons are unadjusted. So that's a little bit of a problem there, but you can only work with what's in the substrate. And they only had 94 patients total. The majority, vast majority, 77 had transtibial amputations. You only have 17 patients with a distal amputation. And right there, you know what I'm going to say? Say it with me. Confounding by indication.
Bing! It's always confounding by indication.
The patients, these are from multi-centers and all that. It's a rare situation where a patient would qualify for this, of course. But there's clearly a decision point here where individuals are saying, all right, this patient not only merits, but we're going to proceed with the attempt of the distal amputation. And there's no way to account for that confounding. They can't account for any confounding, as they admit in their statistical section. So everything that they're showing you is just kind of bivariate, crude, unadjusted comparisons. And that really comes into play because there's the prospect for what we call restricted clinical variation. You only have 17 patients of a certain clinical milieu, and it's not necessarily going to be representative of the entire universe of patients or their potential downstream experiences following these distal, using their terminology, procedures. And then, each individual patient who has an adverse outcome carries a relatively higher weight. For example, the overall need for revision in the distal group, and this is just referencing table 4 for those who are following along at home, they have 4 patients in the distal group, and that's about 24%. Whereas in the transtibial group, they had 10 patients with that outcome, which is about 13%.
Not huge numbers.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and these are not statistically significant, obviously. The differences are not statistically significant. But if you had a larger sample, 24% and 13% are certainly not even in the same ballpark. There's more than a 10 percentage point difference between the two. And if you had larger numbers of patients, that of course would be significantly different. And then it healed at the intended level, uncomplicated. 9 patients in the distal group, about 53%, versus 59 in the transtibial group, which is about 79%. And the p-value for that was 0.07. or thereabouts. So again, not significantly different based on the numbers that they have in their sample, but a very large effect size in terms of the comparisons. You're only going to be able to do studies like this in something like the Outlet study, where you have the major extremity trauma research consortium pooling their data. So don't take this the wrong way. It's not throwing stones, and I recognize the limited context in which they're trying to develop data. But at the same time, you can't just ignore that and say, this is clinically actionable or this is high level evidence, when the fact is that it's materially impaired by the limited sample, plus the potential for confounding by indication, plus the limited power, plus the restricted clinical variation. I mean, I could go on. So, their statements are that basically their conclusions just restate their study findings. I think that this is food for thought for individuals. They can present some numbers, some estimates to patients if they're trying to help them work through a decision around, do you want to try the distal amputation, with recognizing that there's a potentially higher need for more surgery in the future and other complications and lower risk of success versus the downsides of accepting the transtibial amputation. So I think it can help contextualize care for patients, inform discussions for patients. I would be hard pressed to say, okay, well, you know, there, this study could easily be replicated and done better with all the material challenges, both with the substrate and what it takes to study these outcomes. So I think they did an admirable job with a challenging issue. That said, I think that at best, this can just sort of be used as an ultrastructure for shared decision discussions around this paradigm.
At least it gives us some data and some information, but right. Not prescriptive, just informative.
Exactly. Well said.
So talking about information, I'm going to give you some more information, but this all time right. on total ankle replacements. Implant choice may reduce the risk of early mechanical failure in total ankle replacements by Henrietta et al. And there's also a visual summary for this. So when I was in training, not many patients underwent total ankle replacements, and they've definitely rapidly advanced in terms of volume, technique, design, and indications, but they still are at risk for early mechanical failure and revision. There are newer, lower profile implant designs that attempt to minimize bone resection and soft tissue stripping or maximize bone ongrowth into the implant surface, but there's still a risk of micromotion resulting in reduced bone ongrowth at the bone implant interface and a failure of fixation in total ankle arthroplasties versus, for example, total knee arthroplasties and total hip arthroplasties, which have much bigger surface areas. Previous studies have investigated potential risk factors for failure, but in limited to smaller series or older implants. So this study was conducted to identify risk factors for early mechanical failure in modern total ankle replacements. And the authors hypothesized that heavier weight of the patient and ipsilateral hindfoot arthrodesis would be predictors of mechanical failure, and that implants with a greater extent of osseous fixation would be protective against early mechanical failure. This was the single institution total ankle replacement registry from 2016 to 2021. It had 5 surgeons as part of it. They excluded revisions and reoperation total ankle arthroplasties and conversions from ankle arthrodesis. And the primary outcome was early mechanical failure, as was listed in the title. And they defined that as revision with component removal for a non-infectious etiology, such as subsidence, aseptic loosening, and or malalignment. And they did do a sub-analysis to assess specific risk factors for tibial failure compared with talar failure. And they looked at clinical judgment of the surgeon, radiographic support as an X-ray, CT scan, MRI, single photon emission CT, and intraoperative confirmation of component loosening, which is, can be a little bit subjective, but the best that we have in this scenario. And implants were categorized by the extent of overall fixation, stemmed implants, keeled implants, low-profile implants. And again, the sub-analysis was looking at the extent of tibial fixation and the extent of talar fixation in separately ways on the tibial side, stemmed or keeled compared with low-profile tibial implants, and on the talar side, flat cut compared to rounded or chamfer talar components. And logistic regression was determined to see which of these factors had an impact on failure. And this is actually a pretty good size study. 731 patients underwent total ankle replacements. I remember the early ones were like 20, 30, maybe 50 series patients. So 731 patients with a minimum follow-up of 2 years. They said a mean clinical follow-up and a standard deviation of 2.7 plus or minus 1.3 years, but a mean time of 4.9 years since the surgical procedure. So typically just a clinical follow-up, but that's what they said from the time of procedure. So 10% of the patients had hindfoot arthrodesis, and most arthritis was post-traumatic arthritis. All-cause revision rate was 5.6%, and including periprosthetic joint infection. So just looking at mechanical failures, which was their primary endpoint, was 4.5% at a mean of 1.7 years after the index procedure. There was no significant association of age, weight, BMI, or deformity with the overall mechanical failure. And their model demonstrated that hindfoot arthrodesis was associated with 2.7 times greater odds of failure than controlling for other factors. Even though stems were more frequently used in patients with higher body weight, hindfoot arthrodesis and greater coronal deformity, the failure rate was still significantly lower among patients who got stemmed components. But note, kind of similar to what you just said before, this was at one patient. So 0.74%, but that was one patient in this. Stemmed implants were associated with an 83% decreased risk of failure compared to low profile fixation. Then they separated again to tibial failures and talar failures. Tibial failures, again, were not associated with age or coronal deformity or hindfoot arthrodesis, but associated with body weight and tibial fixation. Now we're splitting the baby. We're looking at tibial failures, we're looking at talar failures. Tibial failure was more sensitive to body weight than BMI. So for every 10 kilogram increase in body weight, the odds of tibial failure increased by 1.3 times. implants with greater tibial fixation, such as stems or keels, had a 95% lower odds of tibial failure. For talar failures, they were also not associated with age. They were also not associated with radiographic deformity or hindfoot arthrodesis or talar geometry. But there was a confounding element, as patients with one specific keel implant had a high number of talar failures. So is it the geometry of the implant? Is it just the implant itself that's leading to these talar failures? And that was 6 of the 28 total ankle arthroplasties with the keel stem and chamfered talus did fail. And it all occurred in petite females with size 0 talar implant, assuming that's the smallest implant size. There was an increased probability of failure with heavier patient weight and concomitant hindfoot arthrodesis, and a lower predicted probability of failure with using a stemmed implant. Now, it's hard to adjust for previous arthrodesis and weight. You can control implant type and more, you know, the easier, right? Are you going to have a patient lose weight so that they have less risk of failure? And how much weight do you lose? So that's a hard metric. It's just, an interesting counseling topic for patients. That said, you can control the implant type that you utilize. I see this as kind of like a registry-like look, right? Like this one implant is failing a lot on the talar side. Maybe that's something we shouldn't be using in our patients. If you need to, especially for patients who are larger or previous arthrodesis, more robust tibial fixation, stems, keels, something like that would probably be more beneficial. I parallel this to patients who are obese and in total knee arthroplasty, patients who have a slightly stemmed or implant that are placed on the tibial side tend to do better and have less loosening or failure rates. So there's something to be said about more bony fixation. I'd say that more studies probably need to be borne out in this area.
Yes, interesting work. A lot of patients, as you said, all coming out of the Hospital for Special Surgery and Weill Cornell Medical Center or Medical School. You know, I think this illustrates a point that we discuss quite regularly when talking about power, study power. People conflate that sometimes with sample size, but they go hand in hand to some degree, but they're not exactly the same thing. And, you know, this is a study with a fairly large sample. We can just say it's a large sample, so over 700 patients. But mechanical failure, fortunately for the people involved, is only 33. There are only 33 instances of mechanical failure. So the power of this study is based on the event rate of the outcome of interest. Not you could have twice as the number of patients if you still only had 33 failures. The power is the same. You could have 5 times. You could have 1 million patients if you only had 33 failures. The power of this study for the outcome of interest would be the same regardless of what the overall cohort is. And that does restrict some of what this study really can show. And probably my main critique of this work in terms of, you know, what is usable or what is actionable. Some of their findings are very borderline. The association with hindfoot arthrodesis, for example, point estimate is 2.7 times greater, but the p-value is just marginally less than 0.05. And if we restricted them to just 2 significant digits, it would be 0.05. Studies will always do that when like there's this marginal p-value, and otherwise you would just round it up. If it was 0.65, you would round it up to 0 or whatever. If it was 0.645, you'd report it as 0.65, right? Because whether it's 0.65, 0.7, 0.1, it's all the same, non-significant. But here it's 0.045. That's the only time that you see things going to like that third digit. If it was 0.01, you would just report it as that. So
it has to be under that 0.05. It looks so good then.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah, you have to. So that there's some concern there. They're including in their logistic model 5 potential predictor variables, which means that really they should have 100 failures minimum. A conservative model would really require that they have 120 failures to account for the intercept. So their model is overfit. And this just raises concerns about, you know, what they're showing here, the estimates that they're giving you are probably not going to hold up if translated to another. That doesn't mean that the findings are not relevant or they're not salient. It's just that, you know, hindfoot arthrodesis in your clinical practice or my clinical practice is not going to result in necessarily a close to 3-fold increased odds. Of course, it doesn't translate to our practices anyway. I get that. Like, please don't write and be like, oh, you know, he said that it doesn't apply to his practice, but he doesn't do total ankle. Okay. Neither one of us here is a foot and ankle surgeon. We understand that, but if you are a foot and ankle surgeon and you are listening, I would just caution investing in these point estimates. The general gist, the general scope, the findings are certainly suggestive, and how you would seek to apply those in your practice is ultimately up to you, the individual. But I think that there's a lot of cause for caution here.
Totally second and echo that. And you're welcome for the listeners out there for varying it up and giving you guys a little bit of difference in our articles.
Right. And with that, we're going right back into total joint arthroplasty.
I thought I had to slip that in before we slip to the next one.
Your case is on hold, featurette. The impact of preoperative medical evaluation in an orthopedic perioperative medical clinic on total joint arthroplasty outcomes, an observational study. This is by Vera Reddy and colleagues. It does have a commentary, so you don't have to just listen to us and take what we say, although I think what we say is pretty good. This is work that was done from Dartmouth, Hitchcock, Dartmouth Health Medical Center. The orthopedic department there established a perioperative medical clinic. They say the orthopedic department in our academic health system is, that's actually what it says. So they had me when they were in the orthopedic department, but now it's really more meaningful because it's in an academic health system. What does
changes everything?
What does an academic health system do differently from a non-academic health system?
Teaching, some people would argue, but there's obviously private practices that have teaching and academics, maybe a professorship associations.
Right, but how does that change like your perioperative medical management?
Everything. I'm just kidding. It doesn't. You're right.
Yes. Anyway, they established a perioperative medical clinic to standardize perioperative management and study the effect of this intervention on total hip arthroplasty. So you may be asking yourself, what is perioperative medical management? They established what's called a perioperative surgical home with anesthesiologists as the perioperative care providers. I bet they love that. And they call them perioperativists. So they give them a whole other name and everything. And they integrate the perioperative care.
Is that a title? You know, doctor, perioperativist? Yes. I like this.
Now the emperor of the perioperativists. So it integrates perioperative care and then addresses, you know, kind of the patient in a globalized clinical context is how I imagine it, as opposed to kind of fragmented care where the patient is being seen by different, you got the cardiologist over here and the primary care doctor over there and the endocrine team and whatever other, you know, physicians they may need supporting them. And there have been other studies that show improved rates of on-time surgery starts, reduced anesthesia-related delays, because I guess, you know, the anesthesiologists are having the opportunity to not only see these patients and manage these patients before they get to the OR. So they really have no excuses to like put stuff, like everything is known, right? Like they know that this case is ready to go. Nothing is being put on hold when the anesthesiologists are essentially in charge of like the patient's care for however many days or weeks before they actually come to have the surgical procedure done. So they compared this what they call perioperative 30. Yes, it's 30 days that this is happening, the perioperative surgical home is happening prior to the surgery. They compared this to what they're calling usual care, which is means that the individuals did not participate in the perioperative home. And, you know, it's an overwhelming number of patients, the majority of whom were able to leverage the advantages of the perioperative home model. Interestingly, they did include the interaction between perioperative home and year of surgery, which does make sense because probably as time went on with this initiative, the anesthesiologist became more facile, more familiar, better able to manage everything that they needed. So that makes sense to include that as an interaction because there was probably some effect modulation or moderation there. So you have 82% of the total knees and 74% of the total hips. These patients were in the perioperative home. You know, overall, they found that this decreased the length of stay and the rate of individuals with an extended length of stay for total joint arthroplasty without any effects on the patient-reported outcome scores, which in this case was the PROMIS 10 Global Physical Health. Their conclusion is worded a little bit of, in an unusual way, which is the perioperative 30 decreased mean length of stay and the rate of extended length of stay for total joint arthroplasty without an adverse effect on PROMIS 10 GPH scores. But why would it be postulated to have, why would you think that doing the perioperative home. If anything, you'd expect that it would actually improve, maybe not only enhancing the recovery pathway, but optimizing these patients beforehand, they'd have better. I think they should have better, or at least you could pitch that they had better scores. The fact that there was no difference in scores is probably not surprising, but saying like it didn't adversely impact their scores, I don't know why you'd think that. Agree or disagree?
I agree with you.
Yeah. So, I mean, what do you think about the periop 30 concept in general?
So I like the idea of a concept of someone holistically approaching the patient, right? I think the hard part that we see all the time is everything is disjointed when evaluating our patient. So the nice thing about, I actually visited Dartmouth for Grand Rounds, and when I was up there, it was really nice to talk to the individual who is their perioperative management. And it is truly a comprehensive program, which is nice. Whether or not that's something that can be emulated in all places and will actually make a big impactful difference, I don't know. But I know from a patient standpoint, let's say satisfaction or whatever you want to call it, metric that's not being measured here, there is something about centralizing everything and making sure that all bases are covered. Now, what we do in our own practice is each individual basically does that. So for all my patients, I'm optimizing them. I'm making sure that everything is crossing the finish line. But I'm not a medical doctor, right? So there are certain things that are outside my purview that I'm trying
doctor?
To...
Whoa.
Sorry, I am not an internal medicine doctor. I'm not an internist or a family practitioner or a general practitioner. I
was just at a Holiday Inn Express last night.
It means I just like to cut and I enjoy the cutting part of things. But it is one of those things where it is nice to have someone who sees us on a regular basis, manages hypertension, diabetes, things like that. And right now I send, like, for a patient who has high hemoglobin A1C, I send it to an endocrinologist. You know, I send it to different people. So that's where the centralizing of this, like, preoperative medical evaluation in this, like, medical clinic as a one-stop shopping is a nice thing for patients, I would say. Whether or not it translates to other factors is the question, that if there's a big impact there or not.
Any insights into how they get it paid for?
It's a visit. So it's one of those things where it's not bundled, right? So this is part of the outside of care. It's like seeing your PCP, but it's kind of like what we do with our anesthesiologists, right? It's a visit to the, we call it, our place is called the Weiner Center, making sure they're medically okay. But this is like visiting a medical doctor that's part of your visit. So I don't think it's seen as an annual, but it's seen as a general practitioner or internal medicine visit.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it all depends. Like, you have the very easy patients who this probably seamless, and then the very complicated patients who, I don't know how that works. I mean, at the end of the day, it's like the outcomes were reduced length of stay, lower rate of extended length of stay, and with, you know, bundled payments and things like that, that probably impacts the finances of the institution more than, you know, it's a benefit for the institution more than it's like a benefit for the payer, right?
Right. It's definitely an institutional thing and a patient thing, I would say, right? But not from a payer perspective.
You don't want to be at the hospital forever.
Right. Exactly. So
it seems like the benefits of this are fairly marginal, though. Like, that's what it left me with. Like,
at the end of the day, it's probably not going to be hugely impactful. But that said, it's one of those things that we have as an option. So it's nice. I think the idea here, and this is probably part of clinical care, right? This group instituted, this individual wanted to see the worst to the organization or worst to their practice and things like that. So they actually studied it. I think a lot of times in clinical practice, we just implement something. We don't necessarily study it per se. So kind of doing the systematic and we did the same thing. We had a nurse, I don't want to say a nurse navigator, we had a PA who actually assessed patients and like looked at the lab values, and we wanted to see if that reduced cancellation rates or things like that. So we institute programmatic changes, and it's nice to see if those programmatic changes make a difference or they don't make a difference. So I see that as a study in that kind of realm.
Yeah, I think a follow-on that might be interesting would be to see like if you could like actually monetize, like what are the costs associated with the perioperative home and what are the savings either to the system or the payer, showing some of the, you know, because right now it just seems that the benefits are pretty marginal, but if it's like actually this saved the health system X number of thousands of dollars per episode, that would be a way to demonstrate more magnitude of an impact. Follow-on study.
Agree.
We call for a follow-on study.
I love it.
Honorable mentions. Diagnosis-specific thresholds of the minimal clinically important difference and patient acceptable symptom state for COOS after primary total knee arthroplasty. This is by Amara. So this is a prospective cohort of close to 7,000 patients who underwent primary total knee arthroplasty. This is work that's done at the Cleveland Clinic. And this study basically gives kind of an overview of the MCID, MDC, and PASS thresholds for the Coues Pain, PS, and Coues Jr. for patients with osteoarthritis. It's a prognostic level 2 study. If you work in this space or are interested in patient-reported outcomes, it is definitely worth your read. So check that out when you get a chance. And then the next one is the exposure of Hoffa fractures is improved by posterolateral and posteromedial extensile approaches, a qualitative and quantitative anatomical study. This is by Pease and colleagues. This is from the AO Research Institute in Davos, Switzerland. And they talk about the various clinical aspects of the exposure using 8 fresh frozen human cadaveric knees. The clinical relevance, which I'll just share with you verbatim, is knowledge of the surgical approach, specific visualization of the articular surface of the femoral condyles might be helpful to properly reduce small Hoffa fragments. So those in the trauma space, those with interest from an anatomic standpoint, definitely check that out. If you can believe it, we're already out of time. We'll try to do better next time. But for those of you who have listened all this way, tune in next time. Antonio will be leading the chat, and it'll probably be a whole lot more interesting. For those who didn't like what you heard, thanks for sticking with us. Hopefully, wherever you are, your cases are ready to go, but the cases are all on hold here.
See you next time, and it was great. We're going to have fun again.